Hello, I'm Montse Alvarado. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
Going after a woman's right to really make a decision about her own reproductive choices, and that's to choose to continue the pregnancy that she desires.
New York targets pro-life pregnancy clinics that promote abortion pill reversal in a new lawsuit. We speak with the doctor who invented the treatment on its safety and efficacy.
We are just called to trust in God, even if our infertility is permanent.
Finding support and peace in the cross of infertility, how a Catholic ministry accompanies couples across the U.S.
The fact that our families are suffering greatly today for many reasons, but now we have reached a point where we're seeing plummeting birth rates, we're seeing divorce.
And working to change the culture of Europe to support life and strong families.
They're really going after speech. They're attacking the speech of not just Heartbeat International, but the various pregnancy help centers that are involved in providing abortion pill reversal.
Heartbeat International and 11 pro-life pregnancy centers throughout New York State targeted for promoting abortion pill reversal treatment in a new lawsuit filed by the state attorney general. The Attorney General's office representatives declined to come on to Pro-Life Weekly to speak with us, but provided this quote from Attorney General Letitia James saying, "Abortions cannot be reversed. Any treatments that claim to do so are made without scientific evidence and could be unsafe." Attorney General James says these centers promote false and misleading claims about abortion pill reversal, also called APR. But do they? And how does this all work anyway? We found that most of the centers in the lawsuit do mention abortion pill reversal on their websites. Many provide data and even a video on how the abortion pill itself works and how progesterone works to reverse the abortions, as well as the studies behind it, and even a hotline to call to speak to someone. Dr. George Delgado published the first peer-reviewed article on abortion pill reversal and is the medical director of abortion pill reversal at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. He talks to us now about the science of it all. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Delgado. You pioneered abortion pill reversal. Walk us through how it works.
Well, it's great to be here. And the way it works is that, first of all, progesterone, as the name implies, progestation, is a hormone that's absolutely essential for the maintenance of pregnancy. The abortion pill, mifepristone, is a progesterone receptor blocker. Think of it as a false key that blocks the lock, and the lock is important to open the door to all the good hormone effects of progesterone. So by blocking the effects of progesterone, one of the main actions of the abortion pill, mifepristone, is that the placenta separates from the wall of the uterus, cutting off the lifeline to the preborn baby so that the preborn baby dies. Now, there is a competition going on between the molecules of progesterone and mifepristone. With abortion pill reversal, what we do is we give supplemental progesterone so that there are more good guy keys lined up in front of those receptors, more progesterone molecules to outcompete the mifepristone. So when the mifepristone comes off a receptor, progesterone, the good molecule, is there to go on the receptor in order to convey the good progesterone effects and to save the preborn baby's life.
Now, where is the scientific evidence behind the success of this? What do the critics who claim abortion pill reversal doesn't work say?
Well, they say that we don't have randomized controlled trials and that there's not enough science behind it. They also have used the quite disparaging term of junk science, but instead I say this is really new science. Think about CPR. CPR is a life-saving maneuver that is universally accepted. We do not have any randomized controlled trials where if someone goes down with a heart attack, you look on the list, you say, oh, this person was in the placebo group, we're not going to do CPR. No, once you discover that CPR works, you do it on everybody. So the same thing with abortion pill reversal. It's like CPR for the preborn baby. And we do have lots of scientific evidence actually backing it, including studies in the test tube, which show that the mifepristone and the progesterone compete for the receptors, like I said, and that when you raise the concentration of one, it will win the battle at the receptor. We also have studies done in rats done by Dr. Steven Samud at Franciscan University of Steubenville, showing that in rats, giving progesterone stops the effects of mifepristone and saves those rat pregnancies. And of course, we have our large case series of over 250 women with successful reversals. And then since then, we've documented over 5,000 babies born with after successful APR. There also is one small randomized controlled trial done by Mitchell Crennan, which is actually done to disprove APR. But actually, that study showed that in the patients who are left in the small study, 80% had success who got progesterone. Those who only got placebo, only 40% of the pregnancy survived. So actually, that study, although it was not statistically significant, does suggest that abortion pill reversal is an effective treatment. It also supported our research showing that it is safe. So it's safe and effective, and women are given the chance to reverse their chemical abortions are extremely grateful.
Let's talk about that safety then. Does the abortion pill reversal put mothers or the unborn at risk in any way?
Absolutely not. Our studies have shown that the birth defect rate of babies born after abortion pill reversal is the same as in the general population. A study that we'll be publishing in the next several months is going to show the great safety. I reviewed a study from or data from Heartbeat International, which runs the Abortion Pill Reversal Network now, over 1 year of women starting abortion pill reversal. There were only 9 complications reported, and this was active surveillance where the nurses would call the patients to see how they were doing. So only 9 cases, which were relatively mild, things like heartburn and nausea and sleepiness. And it turned out to be a 0.5% complication rate with abortion pill reversal. That's extremely low. It's extremely safe. We know that progesterone has been used in pregnancy for over 50 years and considered a very, very safe hormone to use in pregnancy.
When you think about the landscape and how it's changing with ballot initiatives being lost across the country, does that affect your ability to use and promote this important protocol?
It does. Unfortunately, people who are ideologically driven are trying to stop abortion pill reversal. In California, the state of has sued Heartbeat International as well as Real Options Obria Clinic in Northern California. However, we're confident that they're going to the state will be defeated in that lawsuit. Thomas More Law Society, which has a great track record against the state of California in frivolous lawsuits like this, is defending the clinic and Heartbeat International. And in New York State, the attorney general there is threatening to go after abortion reversal and stop it. So we are seeing that there are lots of opponents. They're very angry for a simple reason that's been evident in quotes by different abortion supporters, that they realize that if people know that some women change their minds after starting the chemical abortion, that puts a chink in the armor of the narrative that they try to propagate. And their narrative is that abortion is a great good for all women. Well, if it's a great good for all women, then why do some women want to stop their chemical abortions? So that's the reason why they're trying to stop us. It's all ideologically driven.
Well, we're grateful for the work that you do and the research you've pioneered. Thank you so much, Dr. Delgado.
You're welcome.
In New York, a state Supreme Court judge blocked a referendum on Tuesday to enshrine a right to abortion in the state's constitution. The judge says the state did not follow proper procedure. But New York Attorney General Letitia James says she plans to appeal the decision. Current state law allows abortion through the 24th week of pregnancy. In Alabama, groups that help women leave the state to get abortions can sue the state attorney general over threats to prosecute them. In a ruling this week, the judge found that Alabama cannot restrict a person's right to travel, and the lawsuit against the state attorney general, Steve Marshall, can move forward. There are strong pro-life laws in Alabama that only allow abortion if a mother's life is at risk. In Missouri, the governor is signing a bill ending Medicaid reimbursements for any health centers affiliated with abortion providers. That would apply to Planned Parenthood and similar centers. Democrats decry the bill, saying low-income patients will suffer. Abortion is illegal in Missouri, with exceptions for medical emergencies. The Charlotte Lozier Institute released a new research paper analyzing abortion laws internationally and where the United States stands alongside other member countries of the United Nations. What they found was that of 193 UN countries, the United States is one of eight that allows abortion on demand without gestational limits, along with neighboring Canada and Mexico, Guinea-Bissau, China, Vietnam, South Korea, and Australia. The data also shows that on top of the eight countries with no gestational limits, another seven, including Colombia, Iceland, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, Singapore, and New Zealand, permit abortion on demand past 15 weeks of gestation, typically when the heartbeat is detected. In the U.S., while there are pro-life laws in multiple states, 29 states, highlighted here in green, have no gestational limit. Others have a limit at 22 weeks or at viability. The authors of the report say the data shows that the U.S. is a global outlier when it comes to abortion, with far more permissive laws than most countries. On Sunday, May 5th, many U.S. couples observe National Infertility Survival Day. It's annually recognized on the Sunday before Mother's Day. It provides a platform for those struggling with infertility to encourage dialogue, foster supportive environments, acknowledge the emotional struggles, and break down the stigma and silence around it. Mother, writer, and fellow at the Catholic Association, Lee Sneed, has journeyed with the cross of infertility. She writes about it in an upcoming article for EWTN's sister news outlet, the National Catholic Register. Her beautiful article reflects on this juxtaposition of infertility and motherhood as Mother's Day approaches. Lee, thank you so much for joining us. Tell me, what is it that you felt compelled to share about motherhood and infertility in this article?
Hi, Monsi. Thanks for having me on. You know, I think that it's really, it's one of those things that it's just another day in some ways, but in other ways, it's it really hits hard if you're in the midst of carrying that cross of infertility, especially because all of us have mothers. And so there's no way of sort of getting around the holiday or pretending it doesn't happen. Plus, it happens on a Sunday. You know, there's often, you know, mentions of it at Mass. And so as Catholics, you know, we're just Mother's Day is kind of built into the system. And the more I talk about infertility, the more I get asked to talk more about infertility. And so I know that it's something that's on people's minds. But in the same boat, I am a mother now through adoption. And I know that that's not the case for everyone that suffers from infertility, whether or not an adoption hasn't happened yet, whether or not that you're not called to adopt. And so I kind of have a foot in both camps in this, you know, for this holiday. And I just wanted to let everyone know that they're heard.
Absolutely. Well, tell us about your advocacy for adoption then. What does motherhood and adoptive motherhood look like?
For me, it's just the fulfillment of a vocation. It was a natural path for my husband and I to take. It wasn't a second best choice. Obviously, it's less complicated, involves fewer people, you know, if you are just married and get pregnant and have a child. But when that wasn't happening for us, we knew that adoption was the right option for us. It's a big thing, and not everyone's called to it. But for me, it's just a fulfillment of my vocation for motherhood.
And what spaces then are there in the church for couples that need support through infertility, whether they decide that adoption is the right path for them or not?
You know, I don't know. I think there are some people are making some inways for that. There are some special ministries. Whether or not there's a group at your local parish, you know, maybe it's time to start one if there's not one. But I think in general, the mindset of just your everyday parishioner needs to be more inclusive. It's not an us and them situation. We are all part of the body of Christ. And wherever you are on your journey to marriage or motherhood or adoptive motherhood, whatever it is, I think that we all need to just remember each other and remember that, you know, we're all part of the church and we all need to be recognized in, you know, in our own special way.
Well, joining us now is someone that you mentioned in your piece in the National Catholic Register, Cassandra Taylor of Springs in the Desert, a ministry that was created to provide a place of encouragement, respite, and solidarity for couples who are struggling with infertility or experience pregnancy loss. Welcome, Cassandra, to this conversation. You're mostly a virtual ministry, but you do also offer retreats. Can you tell us a little more about how your ministry works on those two fronts?
Sure. So we offer through our website, springsinthedesert.org. We have a blog. We have a podcast that you can find wherever you like to listen. We also have social media channels on Instagram and Facebook. And so we use those to minister to people kind of on their own time. We also have virtual small groups during Lent, especially where we have people coming from all over the world, really. But we also understand that infertility is a cross that is so important to be carried in community. And so nothing can replace those in-person relationships. So we've had several in-person retreats. We're actually having one this weekend in Phoenix, Arizona. And that has been kind of a jumping off point for people to start forming communities in person. And we're working on piloting our in-person small groups as well. So we are walking with you wherever you are.
That's beautiful. Lee, the conversation of surrogacy has been at the forefront at the Vatican and in U.S. policy. How should a Catholic be thinking about their desire for family, that place that's where we all start this conversation about either infertility or motherhood?
Sure. I think that we need to let go of the importance of biological kinship. I mean, however important and sacred that that is, I think that building a family is more about love. I mean, we are adopted sons of the Father through Christ and his mother. I think that adoption is a natural part of our Christianity and our Catholicism. I think that if you emphasize biological kinship too much, it does drive people to pursue unethical routes like surrogacy and IVF. And it also leads people to worry about, parenting a child that's not of their biological stuff, which, I mean, in any case, every child even born to our bodies is a mysterious stranger. And so I think that we need to, as a whole, de-emphasize the need for biological kinship. And I think that that will eliminate a lot of the temptation to pursue surrogacy and other ARTs.
I'm sure that a lot of mothers with teenagers would agree with you that they are parenting strangers. Cassandra, this cross of infertility sometimes can be temporary, sometimes permanent. How do you minister to those two realities?
Sure. So we understand that infertility covers a lot of different spectrums. So there's primary infertility, there's secondary infertility in the case of couples who do have living children. And of course, pregnancy loss is also in the mix. So we understand that couples who are really in this month to month, really trying to conceive, maybe they are doing treatments and getting surgeries, that they're maybe going to need something different from couples who have perhaps been through a medical hysterectomy or have entered menopause. But what we're really trying to emphasize across the board is trust in God, surrender to his will, the surrender of the gift of our fertility to his will. And we know that it's mysterious and that's really hard when month after month it's heartbreak. It's also really hard when you're someone who is post-hysterectomy like myself. That reality is going to look a little different, but our team members are really across the board. We've had team members who have conceived after long periods of infertility, so we understand that this cross is multifaceted, but we're really trying to emphasize that there is a call to holiness for all of us and fruitfulness that can be found for all of us, whether or not we are blessed with the gift of a pregnancy. And so we are just called to trust in God, even if our infertility is permanent, that he will bring forth fruitfulness and great grace in our lives and from our lives and the gift of our marriages.
Now, Cassandra, you're mentioning that closeness to God, and Lee just mentioned the reality of couples who have tried IVF. How do you minister to couples who are on a different path or not particularly in line with what church teaching calls us into in working through the cross of infertility?
Sure. So Springs in the Desert, we adhere to the magisterium and teaching of the Catholic Church, not just when it comes to IVF, but across all artificial reproductive technologies. So we emphasize and acknowledge that that gift, that desire to parent is a good one, but also that we are, yes, needing to adhere to the teachings of the Catholic Church in our personal lives. That being said, life is long and it's a journey of conversion. And so we are there for couples who are maybe coming back to the faith after trying IVF, or, you know, wherever they are, we're not here to be passing judgment. There are a lot of resources that you can look to learn more about the teachings of the church. we're there to proclaim the goodness of God and the goodness of marriage, and we are there to welcome couples back and to be there and to help them maybe get back with God through the carrying of this cross, no matter what's happened.
And through the love of a ministry like yours. Lee, you came upon Springs in the Desert, and it was a very welcome surprise that you are discovering now as well. What do you think is missing in this space for the church to give as a gift back to the laity?
Well, you know, I think that Springs in the Desert is filling what was a missing space. And I wish that I had found someone, a place like them 20 years ago when I was a young Catholic bride dealing with infertility. The resources were slim. And now when you go out there, there's, the conversation is really getting good. Mary Bruno is someone who I think is familiar to all of us, who's written a really wonderful book about infertility and an early age hysterectomy called 12 Stripes Deep. And she's young. She has a great social media presence. I think she's really enriching the Catholic infertility conversation. So I think as long as people keep talking, that void's going to be filled.
That's beautiful. Cassandra, you also provide resources to church leaders. What do those resources look like?
So we offer a pastoral toolkit, which parishes can order, dioceses can order it for their priests. And it's just chock full of all of our resources that we've put together, basically. The most important of those, I would say, is the Pastoral Guide for Ministering to Couples with Infertility that we wrote for priests. To give them a greater understanding of this cross. We know how busy and overburdened our pastors are, so we really want to come alongside priests, not to say, here's all the things you have to do, but here's how we can help you minister to these couples. Here are some things you may not have thought of. Here's why artificial reproductive technologies can be a temptation, and what maybe we can do to counter that, and why maybe it's not the best thing to immediately jump to offering suggestions or suggesting adoption to couples who are struggling with infertility if this comes up in the confessional. So there's lots of good stuff. And we are also offering our small group resources. So we have a curricula available on our website, springsinthedesert.org, for a women's small group. And we are working and dreaming on developing many more so that pastors and pastoral leaders in the church can minister to these couples who are really on the margins.
That's perfect. Well, thank you both. We're going to leave it right there. Thank you for enriching this conversation and continuing to advocate for the church to reach out to those who are struggling
with
this cross. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can learn more about Springs in the Desert, their virtual meetings and in-person retreats by visiting their website, springsinthedesert.org. Coming up, we visit the Southern Hemisphere for a look at their marches for life and a special look at our EWTN mothers ahead of Mother's Day.
But from a natural law, why is this not good for humanity?
Plus, a glimpse at how pro-life leaders are working to build a pro-family culture in Europe. Stay with us. In the first meeting of its kind since the pandemic, the president of Human Life International led a gathering with European leaders to talk about pro-life challenges across Europe. The meeting in Rome during the first week of May focused on revitalizing family values, societal shifts that impact birth rates, and marriage stability.
We've lost a sense of how to speak a common language. What is marriage? What is the beauty of children, for example? So today people think of children as, you know, a burden, a difficulty, a financial concern. But that's not how we approach this wonderful gift of family life. And so we talked about not only the problem, now how do we remedy that? And one of the things we discussed is, how do we bring the narrative back? The issue of surrogacy, in vitro fertilization, human trafficking, migrant workers. When we talk about this, we're inclusive of all that affects the dignity of the human person. And so the remedy is back to the family. Because the family, you know, is where the first school is. It's where, you know, they learn what it means to be compassionate, and they learn mercy, and they learn tenderness, they learn truth, they learn beauty, goodness. And so, but how do we do that now? So we know that's the remedy, but how do we make the remedy known? And that's where we have to put great models. We have to put families, you know, for people to look to.
With culture shifting away from having a family in Europe, Italy has seen a decline in birth rates. This issue is being discussed in Rome this weekend, and Pope Francis will take part. We'll have that story for you next week. In more than 100 cities and towns across Colombia, tens of thousands took to the streets to march for life. On May 4th, under the theme, Colombia, with life there is hope, the demonstrators called on Colombia's constitutional court to annul its rulings that decriminalized and subsequently liberalized abortion. They wore light blue scarves and held light blue flags, the color of the pro-life movement. Hundreds of people took part in the 9th annual March for Life in Rio de Janeiro on Sunday. They met on Copacabana Beach with the support of pro-life leaders. Abortion is not legal in Brazil, but there is a push to decriminalize abortion up to the 12th week of pregnancy. In Dublin, Ireland, thousands flooded the streets with colorful signs and balloons to advocate for the unborn. Speakers urged the public to vote for candidates who are committed to finding ways to reduce Ireland's soaring abortion rate, which saw an all-time high of more than 9,000 last year, according to the Offaly Independent. Speakers also raised concerns on protections of freedom of conscience for healthcare workers who do not want to facilitate abortions. Ireland legalized abortion in 2018. In Oregon, pro-lifers marched in Grants Pass on Sunday, May 5th. Hosted by the Josephine County Right to Life, it featured music, prayer, and pro-life talks by local representatives. The march has been going on for close to 50 years. Oregon has no limits on abortion, and in 2017, a state law took effect, forcing insurance companies to fully cover abortion with no copay or deductible. In Ottawa, a March for Life is being held on Thursday, May 9th. We're going to bring you footage of that march and speak with a filmmaker who has produced a film on the impact the overturning of Roe v. Wade in the U.S. has had on Canada. That documentary, Roe Canada, The True North in a Post-Roe World, premieres here on EWTN on Friday, May 10th at 3:30 Eastern. The documentary follows the journey of two young Canadian women who traversed the U.S. to learn from top pro-life leaders about the strategies and challenges they faced and how they tackle this issue state by state. Sunday, May 12th is Mother's Day. There are many ways to celebrate and honor our mothers. Cards, chocolates, a spa day, or a nice dinner. We wanted to take a moment to recognize the mothers that work here at EWTN by way of a little montage. Take a look. That's it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media pages, including X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for the Pro-Life Pulse, a weekly newsletter at EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.